Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Where food comes from matters, where people come from matter. Author J. Ryan Straddle is from the Midwest. His novel, Kitchens of the Great Midwest, is the South Dakota Humanities Council One Book Selection for 2017. The author tours the state this week. You can see him tonight in Sioux Falls, Watertown on July 18th, and on July 20th, meet him in Pierre. I caught up with one of the state's newest favorite authors for a conversation about grief, walleye, and meeting characters on some of the worst days of their lives. We began by talking about character development.
Well, most of the time, I work on them until I know who they are and they start telling me what they want to do. And then the sort of problems that will expand and define them become clear to me. The sort of obstacles that they deserve to have in their way to expand their personalities become a lot more evident. And it's easier to create the kind of problems that will make them better or worse people. So until that point, I write a ton of material before I create a novel. I mean, but an awful lot of my novel chapters are, you know, the result of multiple drafts once I get to know a character. But that said, I usually don't work from an outline. I'm working from an outline on my new book now, but only because it's the fourth draft. I outline once I'm done, right. And I use it as a means of sorting out what it is I have and what needs to improve and what order everything goes in. But up until then, I just sort of write a character again and again and again until I know them, until I'm involuntarily thinking about what it is that they would do or say.
Do you jump right into a scene, or are you doing a character sketch, or just putting them in different scenarios?
I usually jump right into a scene. I usually like to put them on the precipice of something. I usually like to think about where they would be in their lives that's interesting, that's, you know, either right before or during a period of time that's really going to change them. So, yeah, that helps, because when you create a situation for a character to overcome, you know, how they overcome it really, you know, will tell you an awful lot about them. So, yeah, usually before I know word one about a character, I'll come up with a problem for them. Yeah.
And you said problems that could make them a better or worse person. You make room for the worse.
Yeah.
They're allowed to make the wrong choice, or to make a choice that somehow makes their lives.
Exactly. Yeah, well, yeah. Every so often someone will make a decision that, you know, they wouldn't make in 10 years.
Right.
I don't think any of my characters in Kitchens are bad people, but I do catch some of them at a moment in their lives that, I'd say, you know, are low points.
Yeah,
I'd say with, like, Jordy and Octavia in particular, like, I'm not catching them at their best. Yeah. So therefore, they each make decisions that, you know, are problematic for them in the short term, but I think in the long term, when they mature, they'll realize, you know, that they've learned from them.
And maybe it's a little easier to see in Jordy than Octavia, but with Jordy, that grief, that sort of violent grief that has taken over him is so real to me. And I know that you went through the death of your mother, and I'm just wondering how writing that grief and writing his just, I mean, it's you know, it's so authentic and painful to read at times. How was it for you as a writer to sort of be in that space with a character as he went through something?
Well, it felt really important for me to, as other writers have said better than I am, write about the things that scare you. And that was one aspect of my life that I felt wasn't completely resolved, even close to a decade after my mom died. It was something I was still thinking about and grappling with. And writing Jordy, you know, who's probably the most directly based on me of any character in the book, even though he's a composite with other people, really allowed me to dive into that period of time and write it and inhabit it. And that was hard. You know, that chapter went through the most rewrites. That was the hardest chapter to write. But I think I came out of it feeling like, I did what I set out to do here. And I agree with you that Jordy is, you know, he's in a temporary crisis. This is something that he's working through, and he's not quite old enough or experienced enough in life to have the emotional equipment required to navigate through a grief this extreme easily.
Right.
So he's, you know, reckoning with it in some self-destructive ways.
There are chapters between the chapters so much happens between a chapter. So we see Jordy in one chapter and then we'll see him again.
Mm-hmm.
Did you write those scenes in between to sort of help yourself figure out how he got from the place where we left him in a chapter that's really focused on him to this moment without revealing the ending, the moment at the ending where we see where he's at today? And are those things that you cut away? Or are those just sort of living off, you know, in the margins?
Well, I wrote the chapters out of order, but I did write the ending chapter near the end, so I wanted some kind of resolution to Jordy and some of the other characters that appear in the final chapter, and so I knew I would take that opportunity to explore that. I probably didn't do it with as much detail as I could have, or... You know, the chapter isn't written from his point of view. He's being observed from the vantage point of someone who doesn't know him at all. But I think the reader could ascertain from that point of view character's observations that he's in a different place.
And
that was good enough for me.
Yeah. It's really kind of brilliant from a structural standpoint what you've done here. And reading it the second time through... you know, I paid very close attention the first time, but the second time I saw more of those breadcrumbs that you were leaving me as a reader to find those connections. Are you getting that response from readers where they're just those careful readers? I mean, if you're going to buzz through this on the beach, good for you. But if you're a careful reader, there are some real rewards in there.
Well, I enjoy that kind of experience as a reader myself. Yeah. So I really wanted to do that in Kitchens. And I have heard from a handful of readers who've read it twice. I'm very lucky to have such readers. I heard from one reader who read the hardback and then the paperback and was able to discern the changes I made between the two.
Yeah,
they're subtle, but there's between 30 and 40 small differences between the hardback and the paperback.
All right,
I can just never leave well enough alone.
Okay, tell me one, because I would have read the hardcover when I first talked to you. I would have read the softcover this week, and I can't think of anything. Tell me one.
Well, in some cases, they're covering mistakes, you know, or, you know, doing corrections. Like in the hardcover of the first chapter... I think I refer to Sigmund, you know, he's the brother of Lars and Jarl, who likes Lutefisk, as the middle brother, and then later on, I think, the youngest brother.
Oh, okay.
So I screw up the birth order in the first draft, and that was corrected in the second draft. That's one thing.
And there somebody read that and remembered it.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, someone remembered that, someone pointed that one out. And there were a couple other small things. They were mostly pretty small. The most extreme one might have been at one point, I think it was in Jordy's chapter, I took out a line of Eva's that I thought, it was in the Octavia chapter, I took out a line of Eva's that I thought, oh, Eva wouldn't say that.
Okay, sure.
You know, and I realized, you know, between drafts that, oh, this is uncharacteristic of her. Like, I don't want her to say that anymore. That sounds kind of mean.
All right.
You know, yeah, or snobby. And it was something that, it was an observation she made when she and Octavia were arguing about sweet corn and heirloom tomatoes that I thought was a little mean for Eva. Yeah. And I thought, oh, no, she doesn't have to say that.
Yeah.
You know.
So this So
I made those little changes, but I just felt like you know, if I ever get an opportunity, you know, to change something I've written, I'll do it. I still do it now. I mean, even in my reading copy of my book, it's, as you've probably seen with a lot of writers, it's full of lines crossed out.
You have complete control even at this point because you're the author. So this is a book that you said in previous interviews, I think with me and with others, that, you know, kind of focuses on people who are maybe underrepresented in American literature today. Now, you've met some of those readers on your book tour and heard what they had to say. Has that been gratifying for you to have people come up and say, you know, this is like, you know, the Pat is like my mother. She's the church mm-hmm. lady who made the bars, or something to that regard.
Yeah. Oh, it's been wonderful. Yeah. I feel blessed with some of the best readers I've ever met. I mean, I see different authors I know have very different experience with their readers. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what to expect going in. This is my first novel, and I was kind of afraid that my book tour would be dominated by Q&A sessions with people attempting to troubleshoot my work and calling me out and, you know, questioning my bona fides again and again and again. Just simply because I've seen other authors go through that kind of experience. And instead, no, I had an extremely warm and understanding group of people come up to me over the years and emphasize the points they connected with the book. I mean, every so often I'd hear from people who disagreed with something.
Right.
Especially about the bars, for example. One of the comments I hear most often is that peanut butter bars aren't even actually baked. You know, like they're not as complicated or as good as some of the other bars that you even mentioned. Like, I don't understand why they would win that contest. You know, they're so simple. Like why have these... How have these won so much? Like, they're good, but they're not great, you know? I hear that a lot, and I think that's really funny, and the reason I picked them to win is because of all the bar recipes in the book. They're the ones I like the best. And and I often tell people, well, if you want another bar recipe to win a contest, it's, you know, be my guest. You can write it yourself, because this is, this is what I wanted to win, because this is, when I made the bars, they were the ones I liked the best, and they were the ones I liked the best growing up, and so... If I were a bar judge, I'm sorry, these are the ones I'm picking to win. And I'm grateful for it, because they're the bars I've been served the most when people
make bars. You've eaten a lot of these bars.
So I'm glad I picked the ones I like the best. I have been getting them from people, and it's been wonderful that they've done that. I'm grateful for it. And and so it's been a relief I didn't pick something that
exactly. I kind of thought that was the point with the simplicity of the recipe, and the, you know, that sort of was a metaphor for Pat and how she kind of navigated the world. Food in this book tells the story of lives. Each character, you know, has this food that serves as a metaphor or pushes their story forward somehow, or somehow defines them depending on the chapter. Are you aware of this in your own life? Do you have... food that has sort of, been a metaphor for a certain time in your life, or moved you forward from one place to the next?
Wow, that's a really great question. Since living in California, there's certainly been food out here I've been exposed to that I associate with my time here. I'd say, wine in particular. There's very robust wine growing region in regions throughout California that I've explored in the time I've been here, and I wasn't into wine before moving to California, and I am now. And when I think about, in a similar realm, when I go back to the Midwest now, one of my favorite things to do is try local beer. I think the evolution of beer in our, culinary culture, for lack of a better term, has really evolved in the last 15 years, much more so than wine even. I think I'd say beer stands along the most, significant evolutions of, quality and variety of a food product or beverage product, in America. It's really startling. And the Midwest has always been good at making beer and always been on the map as a beer-producing region, and now it's really reveled in this new community of microbreweries and craft breweries that have emerged across the country. Like, there's even going to be a brewer in my hometown this year. They're opening
in Hastings.
And that's great. I remember thinking about that the last time I was there last summer, looking at the old Hudson Sprayers building, this old brick building right on the river, right on the Mississippi River in downtown, just about, maybe a quarter of a mile from Lock and Dam Number 2, looking at this, wonderful Riverside brick building and think, if this were in Brooklyn, this would this would have a brewery in it, you know, and thinking about, you know, the mixed use space capabilities of this building, and it's like, well, it's in Hastings, so it's unoccupied, but you put this same building just about anywhere else and it's a brewery, and what do you know, I think that is the building that the brewery is going to be in. I'm pretty sure, but I'm not sure. in any case, it ought to be. If it isn't, I don't know what they, you know, if there were issues with what they manufactured at Hudson Sprayers that makes food production on that parcel of land unviable, but I definitely look at downtown Hastings as both a market and in an area that was, you know, kind of needed a brewery. There weren't any, at least that I could find last summer, any local breweries within 5-10 miles, you know, 5-10 mile radius, you know, which this day and age is kind of ridiculous.
Right.
or becoming less likely, you know, so that, Hastings is an untapped market, and there wasn't one in Cottage Grove or Newport or, you know, certainly not in Meesville or Hampton or Prescott. So I'm looking at that region and thinking, what are they waiting for? And it got to the point that writing my current book, I actually did put a brewery in Hastings.
Right, there you go.
Which was fictional at the time. It was wishful thinking, and now I might have to change the name of it.
So a little bit like Eva, you're ahead of things, and things sort of begin to catch up with you. What's it like to go back to your hometown or to come back to the Midwest after leaving for the West Coast and sort of see the way, food culture has evolved, the way literary culture has evolved and continues to evolve?
Oh, I think it's great. Yeah, I mean, I was into food growing up in Minnesota as a teenager, and I felt there were enough variety and choices, even in the 1990s, if you looked for them. I mean, there were certainly farmers markets and all varieties of ethnic restaurants and, you know, burgeoning the scene devoted to the needs and requirements of vegetarians. And,
sure.
And it was, it felt plenty robust, and to see how it's expanded ever since has been really inspiring. I mean, some of the most dedicated chefs and growers I know are in Minnesota, and certainly I really love the work of people like, you know, Beth Dooley and Amy Thielen, and read their books and, you know, and really enjoy how they revel in what that region has to offer. And so whenever I go back, it's such a pleasure to try something I've never tried before, you know, and also to go back to some old standbys, you know, like if I'm in Wisconsin, I'm going to go to a supper club and try the fish fry, you know. So I enjoy the history and the present of Midwestern food as much as ever.
You've been listening to author J. Ryan Straddle. His book is called Kitchens of the Great Midwest. He's in Sioux Falls tonight. Meet him in Watertown on July 18th and in Pierre on July 20th. When we come back, one man's quest to change the world, one photograph at a time. Creatures of the Photo Arc is after the break. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB Radio.